otherwise they'll be used up digesting food instead. The flaxseed was in effect sweeping my colon and helping to physically remove the burrowed parasites from the walls of my intestine. Psyllium husk is also used for this purpose. This was of course coupled with an exclusion diet that already no longer contained wheat and dairy, white rice, corn, carbonated drinks, black tea, coffee, alcohol, or high glycemic fruits. With the discovery of my underactive thyroid, he had tested both my T3 and T4, I decided to try a macrobiotic diet for 3 months to really go for it and detox. In this diet, I included mackerel and sardines at least twice or three times a week for my protein, omega-3 oil, and of course, seaweed. Seaweed is rich in iodine, which would help with the production of thyroid hormones, but it's rare that an iodine deficiency causes abnormal thyroid function. The root cause is almost always in the gut. Dr. Kalibu also prescribed half an ARMA tablet, a small amount of desiccated natural thyroid hormone. I have to say the prospect of this diet was not exactly appealing. Information, recipes, and inspiration were in short supply in 2000, and I'm not really a lover of miso soup or wakame, but I persevered. If I slipped up, I became cross with myself. Did I not want to survive? Did I not care enough about myself to make the effort? The anger helped spur me on to do better next time. I learned to pick myself up after a diet fail, forgive myself, and carry on. Further cheating would only make the problem worse. I hoped my small transgressions would not have severe consequences, although I had no idea of the margin for error. I also had no information on how far I should take my diet. A glucometer would have been mighty useful for tracking the release of glucose into my blood, and it would have given me some tangible data to work with, better feedback, and motivation. I became more obsessive about cutting out refined carbohydrates, but still ate slow-release carbs with high-soluble fiber like sweet potatoes, all while knocking back the supplements and my primordial soup, a vegetable juice, green tea, or olive oil. Ugh. But the feeling of regaining control over some part of my life was not to be underestimated. I was immersed in a world where it would have been easy to have felt helpless, at the mercy of the doctors and my disease. I needed to take back control. Dr. Kalibu also told me my folate levels were very low. Folate and B12 are both essential for the methylation cycle, a biological pathway contributing to almost every important function in the body, like detoxification in the liver, cell repair, and energy production. It also helps detoxify and rid the body of excess estradiol, a strong hormone associated with stimulating the growth of cancer cells. That I was low in these crucial vitamins was of no surprise. I'd been given methotrexate, a chemotherapy drug, which acts by depleting folate so that the DNA, which relies on it, can't replicate. There had been no suggestion of supplementing afterwards. Some doctors are sold on the idea that long-term folate depletion is good strategy. But depletion leads to further cancer, with a particularly strong link to cervical cancer. B vitamins are also the natural victims of the stress hormone cortisol. And of course, every cancer patient is stressed to a greater or lesser degree. Drinking alcohol is also linked to lower folate levels. One study showed that women taking folate supplements and partaking in an occasional drink had the same risk of breast cancer as teetotalers. With Dr. Kalibu's blessing, I took a mega sublingual supplement of 5 grams folate a day for several months, alongside a mega B12 sublingual vitamin. Both folate and B12 are normally made by gut bacteria, so while supplementing was a good idea, I had to address the root cause. It is the lactobacillus colonies in our colons which are responsible for the manufacture of these vitamins, and merely supplementing was not going to fix the problem long term. I learned that fermented foods would help boost my lactobacilli count. However, a common mistake with cancer patients is to focus heavily on boosting fermented foods to the detriment of their bifidobacteria levels, which also need replenishing and may in fact be more important in fighting the disease. Although I was told my cancer was not hormonally driven, I was of the view that the HRT I had been given, which contained the strong estrogen estriadol, was not healthy. I wanted to switch to the weaker form, estriol. It took years of nagging and arguing with my doctors before I finally persuaded my GP to switch to Ovestin tablets, many times weaker than estriadol, but effective at reducing symptoms at a dose of only 2 milligrams a day. Ovestin tablets later disappeared from public view, not because it's ineffective, but because the stronger estriadol is much cheaper to manufacture. This has made getting hold of more biologically identical hormones difficult. I also took a natural progesterone for protection against breast cancer, at first in cream form, which I always felt wouldn't make a discernible difference. I spent 6 years arguing again with my GP, who insisted I did not need progesterone as I had no womb, to finally be prescribed a micronized natural oral form on prescription, a far cry from the synthetic, carcinogenic progestin my gynecologist at that South London hospital had been pushing. I had no idea what an extraordinary difference the oral progesterone would make. It was like sailing out of a fog bank. I hadn't realized what a muggy world I'd been living in. Not only that, my sleep was suddenly deep and restful. Even with melatonin, I had been waking and struggling to go back off. Sleeping for a whole night was something I thought I'd never experience again, but that first night using melatonin and progesterone together came as a complete and very welcome surprise. I believe in eating foods in the best bioavailable form possible to get maximal benefits. Broccoli needs a 4-minute steam. Spinach, I ate both raw and cooked. Fruit, I kept to a minimum, mostly apples and berries. The basics of my diet for the first 3 months after chemo involved miso soup or hot porridge for breakfast with some berries. I would eat small portions of brown rice, fish, salads, broccoli, and other cruciferous vegetables for lunch. I could have made it far more interesting had I used a bit of imagination, but I was too exhausted to make much effort, and the thought of preparing meals was too taxing. It was hard enough just shopping for food. Choices were poor all those years ago. Andrew was regularly subjected to a bland, tasteless meal in the evening, no exotic sauces or flavors, and although he was welcome to make his own meals, he showed admirable solidarity by eating my barely palatable attempts with little complaint. There are now cookbooks and recipes that would have made my initial macrobiotic meals less of an endurance test, but not then. So I approached it like any other challenge, a mental test to see if I was a worthy adversary of my foe. Eating out became impossible, not just because I could rarely find anything I felt I could safely eat. Menus are far more diverse these days, but this was also pre-smoking ban. Within minutes of sitting in a smoky restaurant, I'd have a sore throat, which made me stressed and anxious. Even a trip to the pub to meet friends was fraught with angst because of the smoke. All of this meant I became somewhat of a recluse during the week, only emerging at weekends to breathe that clean sea air, not the smelly fumes of London. I juiced daily. With hindsight, I may have overdone it on the beetroot and carrot. People would often ask if I'd been abroad because of my lovely tan. Oops. My staple was a combination of celery, apple, beetroot and carrot. I wouldn't wash the organic carrots or beetroot perfectly. I'd read about soil-based organisms positively stimulating the immune system, but only if the soil had been properly tended, organic, and from a trusted source. Thank heavens for Riverford Deliveries. There's a name for this obsession, said one of my friends as she watched me prepare a salad. It's called orthorexia. What? I asked, quite sure I had no eating disorder. I've been reading about it. It's an unremitting desire to eat only health food. Well, it's not because I want to, it's because I have to. I hardly think I qualify for the tree-hugging hippie brigade just yet. I was cross that she didn't understand that for me, it wasn't a fad or an obsession born of psychosis. I was astounded anyone could class healthy eating as a disorder, much less put me in that bracket. My friend just raised her eyebrows. Obviously, she didn't understand the link between high glycemic diets and cancer. Neither was she standing in my shoes or reading the research that I had. If people thought I was going too far and saw me as obsessive about my food choices, that was their problem. I was going to do what I thought was right for me. After all, I hadn't cut out carbs altogether, and I wasn't obsessing over every gram. On my next visit to Dr. Calibou, he questioned the wisdom of a mainly pescatarian diet, with only fish and nuts and pulses as sources of protein. You realize you need certain amino acids to build your white cells, he said, and your test results show you're very low on arginine. That helps you detox nitrogen and build white cells too, particularly the natural killer cells.
And there's no arginine in fish?
It's found in game meats like venison and rabbit. These also have much better fat profiles with far more omega-3 than farmed animals. And so a little arginine-rich grass-fed meat and arginine supplements came onto the menu, right at the end of my parasite flush. Recent research has backed this up, showing raised arginine levels help T-cells fight tumors. They also make immunotherapy drugs work better. Meanwhile, my oncologist was very pleased with my progress. She asked probing questions about what supplements I was taking, but I thought it better not to say too much. The list was too long for a start. There was no way I could tell her about the intravenous vitamin C. It was far too contentious an issue, and I'm not sure what she would have made of the ultraviolet blood irradiation or my low-glycemic, iodine-rich, high-soluble fiber, parasite-flushing diet. So I kept my mouth firmly shut. I was sure she wouldn't approve, and I saw no reason to cause discord between us. Nowadays, I would encourage a healthy dialogue, particularly as the internet is awash with far more peer-reviewed research to back you up. She managed to get me enrolled for a trial dendritic vaccine. To this day, I'm not sure whether it helped or not. I had a weak, partial response, but I was sure it was a combination of modalities that helped. The UV blood irradiation is a natural vaccine. The intravenous vitamin C is fabulous for fighting pathogens and reigniting the immune system, and I was improving my gut health with my immune-boosting diet, with herbs and supplements, probiotics, MGN3, the maitake mushrooms, the multifaceted berberine. All of this must have had a direct effect on my response to the dendritic vaccine. Still, from a medical point of view, my ongoing survival was seen as being purely down to the dendritic vaccine. They got very excited about it. I hated to break it to them that I'd more than likely improved my chances beforehand with intravenous vitamin C and improving my gut health. I was told not to expect any long-term effect. The vaccine would only help reduce the HPV component of my disease, which was viewed as the instigator, although it is only part of a bigger equation. But it was not the reason the cancer continued to propagate. In fact, I discovered I was the only patient out of 14 on the trial to survive longer than a few months. I was sad that other women had died, and it made me realize once again just how lucky I was to wake